If you opened your morning newspaper, like I did, the front page of the business section of the New York Times, there was an article that said that even as IBM lays off 13,000 workers in Europe and in the United States, it plans to hire 14,000 workers in India. Just about every day you see another example of how high technology is changing so rapidly that the world you knew just a few years ago, well, it no longer exists. Consider this. In some hospitals here in the U.S., the CAT scan you got this morning might be read by a radiologist in India later tonight. The burger order that you gave at the drive-thru window in Kansas may have been taken by a person sitting in Colorado. Need a personal assistant? Well, you can hire someone in India to prepare your PowerPoint presentation for you. It's a connected world that we live in, and with that connectedness comes change. As more and more jobs move to India, as China turns out an interesting and increasing percentage of the world's scientists, as Russian engineers become a vital part of the American aerospace industry, Americans will be facing a vastly different work environment in the years ahead. These are just a few examples of our morphing world offered by my guest this hour, Tom Friedman, in his new book, The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Are we prepared for these changes? Are we training enough scientists and engineers to keep our technological edge in this fast-changing world? No, we're not, according to Friedman, and the facts back him up. He also says that we are missing a golden opportunity to reshape our energy policy to make the U.S. independent of foreign oil. And this is a topic we have been talking about on this program for years. So it's indeed my pleasure to introduce Tom Friedman, who is the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and the best-selling author. His latest book, as I say, is The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. He joins us from our NPR studios in Washington. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be with you, Ira. Thank you.
That headline was omniscient to us talking about this today. You didn't have it put on the front page today for us, did you?
I wish I could have.
You wrote in one of your columns recently, and it is a theme of your book, with gasoline prices soaring and the biggest beneficiaries being the very Arab dictatorships who are tacitly sponsoring the terrorist killings of Americans in Iraq, it is blindingly obvious that the United States needs a comprehensive strategy for reducing its energy consumption and developing alternative fuel systems. President has utterly failed in this regard. If this seems like such a no-brainer for you, why doesn't it seem like that for the administration?
Boy, I wish I could explain that. I saw a quote from the president just the other day where he was lecturing China and India to become more energy efficient and, in a sense, reduce their consumption. Well, good luck. I mean, I've actually spoken, I've actually discussed in the book, meeting with a group of Chinese students who basically made the point to me, look, you guys got to develop and use all the energy resources you want. Now you tell us there are limits and we've got to hold back. No way. We're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we clearly need an axis of energy to compete with the axis of evil. And the axis of energy to me is so obvious. It's India, China, and the United States collaborating on a Manhattan-like project to basically use China's ability to introduce pilot projects, America's ability to raise capital and provide technology, and India's ability to do a little of both, to put our heads together to find a way to consume less energy. Because if we don't, Jared Diamond in his wonderful book Collapse has a nice way of describing this that I like. He talks about low-impact lifestyles and high-impact lifestyles. And basically, people who live in Western Europe and the United States live high-impact lifestyles in terms of the impact their lives have on the environment and the waste that we produce by our lifestyle. People who live in the developing world, what I would call the unflat world in my book, have very low impact, relatively speaking, lifestyles. Now, what happens when the world is flattened and 3 billion new players walk onto the playing field? It doesn't only just make it a more competitive world and some of the other issues I talk about in the book, but basically we are getting faster than ever before in the history of the planet, more low impact people turning into high impact people. And the impact they are going to have on the environment collectively If we don't find an alternative, we are going to smoke up, burn up, junk up, garbage up, and heat up this planet so much faster than anybody realizes.
Mm-hmm. But the environment has turned into a political football. You know, it's interesting that it was Richard Nixon who created the Environmental Protection Agency, a Republican.
And it's loony. I mean, you know, you have evangelicals who are part of the environmental movement now saying we have to protect God's green earth. I mean, this is good Republican politics. Look at the benefit Arnold Schwarzenegger's gotten in California for his green movement. That's why there's something bloody-minded about this. I mean, sometimes I sit back and think, what are Cheney and Bush thinking? These guys are ranchers. They have their big ranches. You know, they do the ranch thing. They go home and get on cowboy boots and ride horses. Their ranches are going to look like moonscapes in 20 years if we don't do something about this. What could they possibly be thinking? This is not about politics.
You know, what's funny is because we talk about alternative energy a lot on this program. We do a lot of talking with people around the country. And I found it one of the most interesting statistics that we talk about wind energy. Do you know what state has the second highest installed base of wind power?
It's Texas.
Texas. And I talked to people in Texas, and I said, you know, it was under George Bush's watch in Texas when they put all this energy in there. Yeah. They don't recognize the same guy in Texas they see in the White House.
It's really I have to assume it's really about, you know, oil politics and who gives what campaign contributions and, you know, companies and whatnot. So it's really very, very it's beyond disappointing. It's going to be dangerous because, you see, if we don't find a way to address this issue, we are going to find ourselves in a global war for energy, global struggle for energy with India and with China. What's the news this week? China putting in a bid to buy Unocal.
Right.
This huge, you know, American oil company. I mean, if you look at China's foreign policy today, Ira, it's very simple. I can summarize it for you in one sentence. It's called fussing about Taiwan and looking for oil. That is all China is doing.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Talking with Tom Friedman, author of The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. A little early to write A Brief History of the 21st Century.
Well, I said it was a brief history.
I guess it's a good way to write it. You know, I find the tenor of your book, compared to your other excellent books, you've gone from sort of being an observer to an angry participant now.
Well, you know, maybe it's the dad thing in me, you know, I mean, that
these very passionate, very personal pleas that you make.
Because, you know, I just think you can't be a parent and look at these trends, both the environmental trends and the economic trends and the terrorism trends in a flat world and not be worried. As I say in the back of the book, my wife and I dropped off our eldest daughter at college 2 years ago, September. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the profoundly saddest days of my life. And it was not just the mom and dad thing, dropping their eldest daughter off at college. It was a sense I had that I was dropping my daughter off into a world that was so much more dangerous for her as an American than the world she was born into and the world that I grew up in. And I felt like I could promise her bedroom back, but I can't promise her the world anymore. And that really bothers me. That bothers me a lot, and that animates a lot of what I'm writing right now.
Yeah. It seems to me when we talk about, and you write about this a lot, maybe in similar ideas, that when we talk about what is national security, I mean, what constitutes really long-range national security? A good education system, good jobs, good technology, smart people. We don't have that anymore. We don't have the leadership in that anymore. And you would think if it's really talking about national security, that's where you would put your emphasis.
Oh, there's simply no question about it, because the technological base that has produced also the foundation for our military industrial base is slowly going to be eroded as a result of these trends. You know, as I described in the book, quoting Shirley Ann Jackson, who is the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic, which is one of the finest polytechnics in the country, we're in a quiet crisis. And we're in a quiet crisis because it's not going to affect our standard of living this year, 5 years, maybe 10 years. In 20 years, it will affect our standard of living. And the quiet crisis is that the generation of engineers and scientists who were inspired to go into math, science, and engineering 30, 40 years ago by President Kennedy and the moonshot and the Sputnik launch and the challenge of the Soviet Union. That generation is retiring now, in some cases dying off. Now, we never fully replaced that generation. What we did was we imported replacements from India and China primarily. Now, two things have been happening in the last 5 years during the brief history of the 21st century. One is 9/11, where we're telling people, stay home, stay home. Your name's Mohammed. You once went through Riyadh Airport and stay home. Your name's Rajiv, and we don't like what you're researching. Stay home. So that's part of what's happening. And the second thing that's happening is the world is flat. And when the world is flat, you can now innovate without having to emigrate. Well, if I can innovate without having to emigrate, it means I can stay back in India, wear a sari, eat curry, live in my extended family, and not move to snowy, frigid Minnesota where I'm from, uproot myself from my culture and my family in order to be an innovator. I can now innovate at home. And so these people, not only aren't they coming, but some who are here are going back. I was just in Bangalore just a couple weeks ago, interviewed the head of Microsoft Research there. Microsoft Research has just opened its fourth research center in the world in Bangalore, adding to the one in Redmond, Washington, the one in Cambridge, England, the one already in Beijing. And the most interesting thing the head of research there told me was that his first two hires were a Japanese and an American. I went to Infosys, the crown jewel of Indian high technology, the Microsoft of India. So we're walking through the lobby. The spokeswoman says, you know, the interns heard you're here and they wondered if you'd stop by and have a talk with them. I said, oh, that's great. I'd love to meet your Indian interns. No. Our American interns. I said, what? You have them? Yeah. She said, we got 9,600 applications last year for interns from around the world, not just Americans. And people in Bangalore, this isn't about call centers. These people aren't racing us to the bottom. They're racing us to the top.
All right, Tom, stay with us, everybody. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Tom Frieden, author of The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Open the phones, take some of your calls, and talk about this crazy world we live in. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about technological change with my guest, Thomas Frieden, foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, best-selling author. His latest book is The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Our number, 989-8255. That chapter, of course, for us, Chapter 7, where you talk about the quiet crisis, when we talk about science and technology on this program. It really is the kind of thing that sneaks up on you, and it gets absolutely no attention. You know, education, jobs, and I think there was really an interesting point. That one of your points that you made was something called the ambition gap, where kids are not being motivated to better themselves in the U.S. anymore like they used to.
Well, you know, you really see when you go to India and China, what you have to understand is that it isn't just that they've gone capitalist. These two countries are like uncorked volcanoes. 50 years of pent-up, basically, frustration at not being able to participate in the global economy, at not being able to achieve their aspirations. Think about it. You know, India has these MITs. They have eight. They're called IITs, Indian Institutes of Technology. Since they were founded in the 1950s by Nehru, they've graduated about 150,000 people. Do you realize that roughly a third of them are in America? So if you were one of those IIT grads who couldn't get a green card to come to America, it meant your skills rotted on the docks of Mumbai, basically. And you really couldn't, you know, create and innovate at the highest level. Well, when the world is flat and suddenly you can do that, the amount of unlocked pressure, and it starts not only at the top, or it comes not only at the top, at the IITs. Again, I was just in Bangalore a couple of weeks ago. The big move in India today is from farmers and Dalits, I mean the lowest castes, who are demanding now that in the public schools, English be taught beginning in the first grade, not just in the fourth grade. And so, I mean, I talked to an Indian friend just yesterday. He's telling me his maid, you know, basically spends three quarters of her income to send her kid to an English-speaking school, understanding that English is the key to get into a technical school, is the key to success.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to, and I know you mentioned him in your book, I was talking to Craig Barrett of Intel a few weeks ago at a dinner, and he was saying that he had a conflict. He said, you know, I'm chairman of the board of Intel, but I'm also a grandfather. He said, I don't have to hire another American person.
That's right.
I don't have to build another factory. In fact, we sell most of our stuff overseas now. But he says, I also have a conflict about being, if I do that, about being a grandfather and what kind of country I'm going to be leaving behind for my kid.
Well, you know, I had the same conversation with Craig. I wrote a column about it because he put it in a very stark way that shocked a lot of my readers. He pointed out that Intel today basically earns about 75% of its revenues overseas, yeah, because the growing markets, the markets where people are buying PCs, you know, and using chips, you know, faster than ever, is in Latin America, Eastern Europe, India, and China. It's not here in our mature market. And the other point he made was that Intel can thrive. Intel can thrive as a company today and never hire another American. Because in this flat world, it's going to go where the talent is. And if it can't find the talent here, more mm-hmm. easily than ever, it can find it and will seek it out in India and China.
There's going to have to be a day of reckoning. Somewhere the balance sheet's going to have to balance out. And for this country, where do you think that and when do you think that's going to happen? Is it going to be a catalyst for that, or is it just going to sneak up quietly and suddenly?
Yeah, I think it will. It's the real danger of this kind of phenomena is the frog in the pail syndrome, where, you know, the frog is in a pail of water and you just slowly turn up the heat. And at each new degree, the frog kind of adjusts and adapts until it boils to death because it doesn't think to jump out of the pail. It's so used to kind of adapting. And that's really what worries me, and it's why I've called for, you know, a Manhattan Project built around energy independence as the new moonshot of our generation. Because, as I say, and as Shirley Jackson says, you know, it's not going to be next year, 5 years, but 15 years we'll wake up and we'll find that innovation, the kind of innovation that was producing the Googles and the Yahoos,
right,
isn't happening here. And where innovation happens really matters. Boy, if you don't think it's important for Silicon Valley that Google is there, think of all the mathematicians they've been hiring in the last few years. And then the companies building up around Google to do consulting and spin-off work from there. And therefore, all the incomes they're producing and the restaurants they support and the schools and the hospitals and the services and the plumbers and the maids. So yes, we may get a piece of the work, but if the headquarters isn't here, if the marketing, the CIO, the CTO, the top jobs, the best paying jobs aren't here, that really matters.
You know, it also struck me some time ago that this would be the war on terrorism, the fact that we had a big blackout a short time ago, electrical grid meltdown. This would be a great time to say to the country, hey, you know, let's redo our infrastructure and then let's redo it in such a way that we could create these alternative energies, these wind farms or hydrogen or whatever, and then we can all do it at the same time. You know, and we may have to sacrifice a little bit, like Jimmy Carter asked us to sacrifice during the first oil embargo. But, you know, it'll all be worth it in the long run. It doesn't seem like there is the stomach for that kind of a request for sacrifice or a long-term commitment anymore.
Well, you know, after 9/11, I think history will show that President Bush missed an incredible opportunity, and history will not be kind to him for that, because we had a chance to, he had a chance to impose what I called for at the time, a Patriot tax. And the Patriot tax would have been a dollar a gallon of gasoline right at that time. And the argument, you know, would have been, this is how we will change people's behavior. This will stimulate hybrid technology. It'll stimulate automakers. It'll stimulate mileage changes. It'll reduce our consumption of foreign oil and therefore the money available to these regimes out there who are supporting the very people who want to destroy our society. At the same time, by the way, it would force those regimes to start changing and reforming. The fact that he did not do that, the fact that instead he basically told us to go shopping, I think was a tragic, historic mistake and one that we've paid for. Mm-hmm. In fairness, though, to him, where was the Democratic leader who called for that? I didn't hear him or her either.
Yeah.
And I think it was a colossal failure of leadership.
Also, you see that General Motors lost $1 billion in its last quarter. And now to play catch-up, it has to buy its hybrid technology from Toyota. And is this not deja vu all over again?
Yeah. I mean, to think that Toyota, their what, 10,000 miles away, sitting there in Japan, figured out the American market, what American consumers would want and need. Head of General Motors, you know, it's clear to me. It's as clear as day. As Toyota goes, so goes America. Mm-hmm. You know, as I wrote the other day, Ari, if I'm rooting for General Motors to go bankrupt and for the entire leadership of that company to be fired, does that make me a bad person? Because I really think that the employees of General Motors, not to mention America, as a whole, would be so much better off if they were taken over by Toyota.
Mm-hmm. Rusty in Oregon, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you for taking my call. Actually, you've come full circle back to the issue that I was quite interested in, and that's the lack of leadership in Washington. Earlier in your conversation, you mentioned that you seem to be decrying the fact that people were not able to solve problems. I think the current administration are not problem solvers. They are disciples of an ideology, and they're much more interested in implementing the trappings of that ideology than solving the problems in a practical, pragmatic way.
Tom, any comment?
Yeah, I think there's certainly a lot of truth to that. I mean, if you look at, there's evidence for that, particularly if one looks at the Social Security issue, what the people want. It's obvious from the polls what people want is for Social Security to be fixed, okay? And that's a math issue, okay? Mm-hmm. Who can retire when at how much? Let's get the numbers in line, working right, and make it so everyone will be assured their Social Security will be there, you know, till the middle of the next century. Mm-hmm. That's what people want. This private accounts issue is some kind of ideological, you know, conservative fetish that came out of a think tank that has absolutely no grassroots energy behind it at all. And by making that the priority as opposed to fixing Social Security, we're going to end up with neither at this stage. Because and clearly the administration has run into a brick wall on this.
Are we able to tackle big issues anymore? I look at all these different issues, and can we span not generations, perhaps, but administrations and get things done that need to be done over a long period?
That's really a good question, Ira. I mean, you know,
it would be true of the energy policy, be true of health insurance,
anything. Iraq, I mean,
is the politics in such terrible shape now that, you know, I'll just wait you out and I'll slash and burn whatever you did, you know?
That's right. I mean, it's. I don't know where this red states, blue states thing came along. I was raised in the United States. You know, I come from Minnesota. I'm not a partisan political person by nature. I'm not at war, you know, with anybody. You know, I'm left of center, I think, on domestic issues. I might be a little right of center on use of force and war issues. But I try to come to every issue in terms of, okay, what do I think is right? Who's got the best answer out there? And let's try to push that solution. And look what I just wrote about this today. I mean, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I mean, this is such a slam dunk, so obvious in our interest. We just spent a decade of the 80s trying to prevent Latin America, Central America, from going communist. And now we're terrified that they're going capitalist? I mean, this is so obviously in their interest and in our interest, but Democrats are opposing this just because they want to hurt Bush. And my attitude is, okay, I understand you want to hurt Bush. You want to make sure he's not reelected. But can't you focus on things where he's clearly wrong about, not something where he's right about? And it's that unwillingness. What do we read in the paper today? Karl Rove, you know, basically attacking liberals as a bunch of lily-livered wimps for their position post 9/11. Like, where does that come from? You know, I'm one of the liberal hawks, in fact. I mean, where do I fit into that? I mean, what good does that do? Now, we got a big problem in Iraq, and this bozo's out there calling names in New York City? I mean, what is that about?
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Peter in Dothan, Alabama, is it?
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I mean, all you smart people talking about all these things, but nobody seems to want to address the issue that seems to be blocking, let's take, for example, alternative energy, is that there are powers in this country that's not just the Saudis who are profiting from the high price of oil, but and centralized energy. But I think there are people in this country that don't want alternative energy to flourish because it's very possible that it will decentralize the way the internet has, and people won't be getting all their energy through a meter people might, you know, be able to get their own energy from the sun. And this is so much political blockage for it. Carter started to subsidize alternative energy, and as soon as a Republican came in, there it went.
That would make the Earth even flatter if energy were decentralized.
You know, it's an interesting point, but I think the caller has a point. I mean, you know, I think, you know, companies like Exxon and whatnot and General Motors, you know, General Motors fought tooth and nail any effort to increase mileage standards. Exxon, for a period of time, funded people who denied there's climate change going on. There are definitely vested interests that are working against this. And that's why I so admire, you know, people who are going out and rejiggering their Priuses. You know, we as a family, we own three hybrid cars, and and there's a lot of people out there sort of, I think, you know, wise centrist Republicans, people like George Shultz, who drives his hybrid car around the Stanford campus and is an evangelist for hybrid cars. And now, as the caller alluded, you know, people are discovering that if you rejigger your Toyota, you're going to lose your warranty, but you can turn it into a plug-in hybrid and basically get the first 20 miles, you know, on electricity, and then only after that the gas kicks in. Yeah. And so maybe this is going to just emerge from the ground up, Ira.
We're talking about technology. This hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
But, you know, I want to add, can I say one last thing
sure.
at this point?
Sure.
Which is that where are college kids today? You know, why aren't college kids calling for disinvestment from any company that isn't promoting, you know, energy alternatives and efficiencies? Why aren't they declaring their campuses Hummer-free zones? If you want to drive a Hummer, you go to Iraq.
Well,
okay?
A corollary to that question, because I think we're both about the same age. What happened to the 60s generation? What happened to all of us in the 60s who were of that ilk and that mind? Why aren't we out there? You know.
Well, it's a very good question, and I think that we all have to look in the mirror, and I think everyone has got to, as an individual, ask what are they doing to make themselves and our country more energy independent and a greener country. Because if you're not doing that in the flat world, when we are going to be getting hundreds of millions and already are high impact people onto the new platform, boy, the world we're going to be leaving our kids is not going to be pretty. If you want to see what it looks like, go to Bangalore, sit in the traffic there for an hour. Look at what's happened to the water, to the air, to the land around there, and then just multiply it, you know, time and again. In Beijing, 1,000 new cars are added to the roads every single day.
The Chinese are going to be, you know, we talk about we're losing, we're heading, there are people who say, no, we're there already. You know, the best technological times of the U.S. is in the rearview mirror, if you want to see them. These other countries produce us. China, when the Chinese want oil, they just buy big oil company. They want food, they're going to buy up the other food. You know, they are already the 800-pound gorilla.
Well, there's some truth to that, but I still have a lot of faith in America. I think we're best in a crisis. Excuse me, I still think we have a lot of assets going for us. We have the best research universities in the world. They are still the envy of the world. We have the best, most efficient financial markets in the world. They are still the envy of the world. We have the best rule of law. If you invent something, you want your intellectual property lodged here and protected here. We still have all the secrets of the sauce, but we're not tending to them. We're just eating our sort of seed corn, basically.
Let's go to the phone.
Look at last year. Yeah. What did we do? The Congress last year, this Republican-led Congress, cut the National Science Foundation budget by $100 million. Now, how dumb is that?
You won't get an answer from me. We're actually, in full disclosure, we actually are funded by partly from the National Science Foundation. But you're right. It is.
Of all things to cut. I mean, cut anything. Cut subsidies for cotton or sugar, maybe. But not the National Science Foundation. We should be We should be increasing it by $100 million. And as Vern Ehlers, he was a Republican congressman, you know, says in the book, this is exactly the wrong time. How could we possibly be doing this? And yet, not only did they do that last year, but this year they're talking about cutting the Defense and Energy Department research budgets.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more with Tom Friedman, author of The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Some more of your calls and trying to bring a little more sanity to the world. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour with Tom Friedman, foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. His latest book is The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Spencer in Paw Paw, Michigan. Hi, Spencer.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm a 14-year-old high school student. I'm interested in foreign affairs. And I read an article by James Fallows in the Atlantic Monthly for this month that was sort of a doomsday prophecy for the American economy on its current course. I was wondering, firstly, if Mr. Friedman had read this article and if he had what he thought of it. And secondly, what my future as a 14-year-old potentially looks like from your standpoint.
Thomas?
Wow.
Kids are scared out there.
What a wonderful question.
Very
thank
articulate.
You for calling.
Yeah,
thank you for calling. Email NPR your address. I'd love to send you a book. email Ira Flatow. Well, I say two things. One is I did read the article, as a matter of fact, and it's a brilliant article. I mean, it's basically builds on the notion that we're building up unsustainable problems, basically, in terms of the deficit, the falling dollar, our incredible dependence on China, Japan and Korea buying up our debt. And that it's all kind of predicated on the assumption that nothing's going to go wrong. And this article basically outlines, you know, what happens if just one thing goes wrong and the kind of meltdown that can occur from that. And I thought it was a very compelling piece. You know, whether it's all going to play out that way exactly when or how, I don't know. But, you know, markets are funny. Everything, you know, seems to be going along just fine until it isn't. Mm-hmm. And you never know when or why or how that's going to happen. But I think that was one of the themes of the piece. As for you, you know, what I would say is, you know, it's been interesting being on a book tour and going around America talking to people. And I've had a lot of parents, you know, come up to me and ask questions. One of my favorite is parents who come up and say, my son is studying Chinese. He's going to be okay, right? And, you know, my standard answer is that the real skill that you need to succeed in a flat world is you need to be able to learn how to learn. That's the most important skill you can have, because jobs are going to change so quickly. And whoever heard of Google, you know, 10 years ago, yet now here's this whole new industry search. And the ability to learn how to learn is the greatest single asset you can have in a flat world. Now, then the question is begged, as a ninth grader in St. Paul asked me, well, how do you learn how to learn? And I think to learn how to learn, you really have to love how to learn. And then the question is, well, how do you love how to learn? And this is what the young man asked me. And I said, you know, my advice would be this. Ask your friends, who are the best teachers in your school? You're going into ninth or 10th grade next year. Ask, who are the best teachers? And take their courses, no matter what they're teaching, whether they're teaching Greek mythology or physics or statistics, because it's the best teachers who teach you to love how to learn. And the best way to learn how to learn, the only way to learn how to learn on a consistent basis as a lifetime venture, is to love how to learn. And so I think back of the teachers who really inspired me. I don't remember much today about what they taught me, but I sure remember enjoying learning it.
Thanks. I appreciate the advice.
Spencer, don't go away. We're going to put you on hold, okay? So hang on there. 1-800-999-8255 is our number. At least there's some people thinking about the problems.
That's wonderful. That's why I'm an optimist still.
Yeah. You're a romantic at heart.
Yeah, I am. I'm a Minnesota optimist. I can't get that out of me. Even 10 years in the Middle East didn't leach that out of me. You know? But, you know, when a young man calls up like that and is clearly, you know, he's listening to NPR, he's interested in the world, he's clearly articulate, we got all the raw material here. But what is so missing right now, you know, is a leadership at the top to galvanize, to inspire young people like that. You know, look at Washington. It's all midnight meetings about Terry Schiavo and not a daylight session, you know, about hybrid technology.
Well, yeah, I think the media has to take some blame for
this. No question.
You know, whether the commercial media just owned by the entertainment industry now. Why put on something, you know, something that you have to think about because somebody else will turn the channel and go to something.
No, it's all Michael Jackson and Terry Schiavo and the latest, you know, young white girl who went missing, you know, basically.
Mm-hmm. Not very optimistic. Let's go to Praven. Mm-hmm. Praven in Charlotte, North Carolina, is it?
Hi, yeah.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I had a quick observation about the Bangalore issue. I was in India a couple months ago for my brother's marriage, and I hadn't been back in a while, and I did notice that, you know, my adolescent cousins, 14 and 15-year-olds, sporting these cell phones, these absolutely fantastic gadgets with, like, cameras and, you know, the video players and whatever. Just absolutely crazy gadgets. And I remember growing up that time, and I didn't, of course, have a cell phone. And, you know, I've spent most of my time here in the U.S. for the past 10 years. I go back, and there's been such a sea change in terms of technological advancement there. But I'll tell you, though, you know, you still have to bribe people every step of the way to get things done there. So I think this country is fantastic because it affords immigrants like us, like personal liberties, you know, a sense of social justice, which is still not available in third world developing countries. And that was my observation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's a very good point, and I thank that the caller for that, because it's why I'm still an optimist about America. It's why I said, you know, why do so many people want to come and have their intellectual property lodged here? It's really what that caller said, because of our rule of law. You can't get that in other places. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a slam dunk that China and India are going to overtake us. You know, I wrote about this from Bangalore a couple of weeks ago, because whenever you're in India, people always ask, compare us to China. So I said, okay, here's how I see India. Here's how I see China. China is like a 6-lane superhighway. God, cars are going 80 miles an hour. The road is perfect. The streetlights all work. But off in the distance, Ira, mm-hmm. there's a speed bump in the road. And that speed bump is called political reform. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, when 1.3 billion people going 80 miles an hour hit a speed bump, one of two things happen. One, the car jumps up in the air, slams down, and everyone looks around. You okay? You okay? Yeah, okay. And it drives on. The other thing that happens is the car hits a speed bump, jumps in the air, and all the wheels fall off. And we do not know what's going to happen with China in that regard. Now, India is also like a, you know, another highway, only it's full of potholes. Half the streetlights don't work, and the sidewalks where they even exist are crumbling. But off in the distance, it looks like the road smooths out. The question about India is that a mirage or is that the real thing? So both these countries also, like us, have huge question marks. It isn't a slam dunk that they are going to overtake us at all. And the more they develop, those development that prosperity will also produce its own problems along the way.
Mm-hmm. Do you see this whole issue about the U.S. and its global warming stand almost virtually against the rest of the world as playing itself out somehow and affecting technology, affecting, you know, the way?
Well, here's how it's going to play itself out, you know, because you see, when you go to Bangalore, when you go to India, when you go to China, what do you see? I mean, they have huge environmental issues facing them now. Now, for their own internal reasons, they are going to develop low-cost solutions to those environmental problems for their own reasons of survival. But the whole question of green technologies is going to be a huge, huge issue in the flat world as all these people go from low-impact people to high-impact people. Now, imagine, Ira, if we had a president who said global warming is real, the science is clear, the Academy of Sciences has told us that. Let's create the laws, the incentives, the pressures and opportunities for our businesses now to be leaders in these green technologies. Well, this is going to be a huge industry in the future. So instead of us leading the way on it, we're going to let China and India innovate for their own reasons, the low-cost solutions, the low-cost platforms, and we'll end up buying it from them. Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
We talked about the car industry. The American car makers won't be making a car that the Chinese want to buy.
That's right. Well, India's now innovating. Look what's going on in India. They're innovating. Tata's producing a $2,000 car, a $200 laptop. They have an airline, Deccan Air, that flies between New Delhi and Bangalore, 3.5-hour flight for $75, and you buy your tickets through an internet kiosk at gas stations. Okay, $12 cell phones, $10 health insurance for a year. They're innovating because if you're an Indian company today, okay, you want to sell to the Indian market, you have got to innovate really low-cost solutions. Mm-hmm. Now, once you start to perfect those and you start making money in rupees, and then you take that platform global to America and Europe, you have a monster. And that's why the smart American companies, they're in China. Companies like Cisco, you know why they're in China? It's not just to sell there. It's because Cisco knows if it cannot compete head-to-head with Huawei, the Cisco of China, in China, it's game over. Because if Huawei can make profits in that low-wage Chinese market selling routers, and then they take those routers global, Cisco's out of business.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that the U.S. Labor market then will have to force itself to compete by lowering its wages?
Well, not necessarily. That mm-hmm. only depends on whether we continue to innovate the new products here. Mm-hmm. Because, two things happen when the world goes flat, basically. One is the global economy, first of all, it gets bigger. There's more people to sell more stuff to, particularly the kind of stuff we specialized in, idea goods, branded goods, consumer goods, electronic technologies, films, creative things, all the stuff that, as Dan Pink calls it in his book, the right brain stuff, mm-hmm. basically. So we have all the ability to do that as this economy grows, because it's not only going to get bigger, it's going to get more complex. But if we aren't doing the innovating here, someone else will do it, and we will not reap the benefits of that.
Yeah, we have to have the brain power here to do it.
Yeah, you got to have the brain power. You got to have the context where the innovation is going to happen. And, if we get more and more companies, like Intel for their own survival, Intel has to be responsible to its shareholders, basically saying, we're going to do, the innovation more and more based on talent somewhere else. At some point, you'll get a tip. And basically, that the locus of innovation will move there and not here.
Talking with Tom Friedman this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Author of the book The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century. I just want to go back to one really, sort of interesting that illustrates anything, if anything, about how flat the world is, and that is the fact that you can drive up to a burger joint and order something, and you take it from there. Where does that order go in some of these places?
This was a pilot project McDonald's was doing. The Washington Post wrote about it, and basically you drive up to the window, and at your favorite McDonald's in certain locations, and you're actually talking to a call center in Colorado Springs when they're taking down your order, in some cases also taking your picture. And then they zap your order and your picture together to that McDonald's where a food preparer prepares it, and they discovered that basically they drove down their error rate of taking these orders to a significant degree when that's all you did at the call center was take down the order, and it also sped up food preparation. So the world's being flattened around you. I was at a book party the last weekend, a woman came up to me. She's a quadriplegic, an extremely bright, intelligent woman, works in the legal field. She's a lawyer. And she said, we weren't even talking about my book, but she was talking about her business. She said, I outsourced that, mm-hmm. When quadriplegics understand that they can actually disaggregate some of their business, take advantage of the flat world, that's a wonderful thing. But it also shows you how much now this flat world is down to the individual level.
Yeah.
You as an individual have to locate yourself in this world, locate yourself on the flat platform, and see how to make it work for you. And wealth in the flat world is going to go to those countries, those companies, and those individuals who understand this flat platform that I describe in the book and how to get the most out of it for them and their people.
You know, Americans used to be known for Yankee ingenuity. It seems like a lot of people have picked up Yankee ingenuity now and are running with it.
Yeah, there's no question. Look at, well, you know, to me, the metaphor for the United States was our Olympic basketball team last year. You know, look what happened. I mean, you know, we showed up and we won the bronze medal. And why? Because, first of all, other countries, they're now scouting us. They're now adopting our coaching methods. They're adopting our training methods. Their people are coming here, learning our basketball skills and going home and playing for their own teams. We aren't a bronze medal country. But that is where we're going to go if we stay in this mode of fat, dumb, and lazy. Because there are a lot of very energetic and ambitious people out there. And as Bill Gates points out in the book, you know, if 30 years ago you had a choice of being born a B student in Bethesda or a genius in Beijing or Bangalore, well, there's no question. 30 years ago you wanted to be a B student in Bethesda. Your life chances were so much greater. Today, when the world is flat, you do not want to be a B student in Bethesda, because every B plus student, not to mention every genius in Beijing and Bangalore, can now connect, collaborate, and compete with your kids in mind.
But we still need, in the last minute that I have, we still don't have any leadership. I mean, we used to have, you know, you talked about the 60s, you talked about the environmental movement. There were real leaders who used to be on television every day. They weren't all political leaders, they were professors, whatever. I don't see anyone out there now who says, let's change this, we need to do that.
That's true. In the business world, you know, they know better. These guys know we need health care. They know we need better education. But, you know, they've been kind of mute. You know, several people have asked me, who would you like to read your book? And for me, it's a slam dunk, Ira. Who would you like to read it most? George W. Bush. Because, Ira, we don't have 3.5 years to waste. I don't know whether I've got all the answers, but I hope I've asked the right questions. And that's who I would like most to read this book. I would love nothing more than to get behind this president who adopts an agenda of making us energy independent, using that to inspire young people to go into math, science, and engineering, because we do not have 3.5 years to wait and hope that somehow someone else will come along who finally gets it.
All right, Tom Friedman, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thomas Friedman is the foreign affairs columnist for the New York Times, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and best-selling author. His latest book is The World is Flat, A Brief History of the 21st Century, written with a lot of passion and a lot of details, and I highly recommend it for you to pick up a copy. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Ryan Havers in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today, as we always do, from NPR librarians Kima Leskey and Alphonse Finn. If you missed any of the program, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We're now podcasting Science Friday. Take it with you on your iPod. You can listen on Real Audio or on your Audible player anytime you'd like to. Also, you can leave us email at sciencefriday.com and listen. You can hear all the back editions of Science Friday, and you can also send us any suggestions for future programming. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.